Wheel around. One takes a swig from a flask, leaving a golden stain on his lips.
Little cat up in a tree, another calls. Come down for the foxes.
I push myself to my feet, mindful of the ghost's lessons as I run along the branch. Three riders circle below me. There's a flash in the air as the axe flies in my direction. I duck, trying not to slip. The weapon whirls past me, biting into the trunk of the tree. Nice try, I call, trying to sound anything but terrified. I've got to get away from them. I've got to get higher. But then what? I can't fight seven of them. Even if I wanted to try, my sword is still tied to my horse, and all I have are a few knives.
Come down, human girl,
says one with silvery eyes.
We heard of your viciousness. We heard of your ferocity,
says another in a deep, melodious voice that might be female.
Do not disappoint us.
A third notches another black-tipped arrow. If I am to be a cat, let me give you a scratch, I say, pulling two leaf-shaped knives from my sides and sending them in two shining arcs toward the riders. One misses, and the other hits armor, but I hope it's enough of a distraction for me to tug the axe from the wood. Then I move. I jump from branch to branch as arrows fly all around, grateful for everything the ghost has ever taught me. Then an arrow takes me in the thigh. I am unable to bite back a cry of pain. I start moving again, pushing through the shock, but my speed is gone. The next arrow hits so near my side that it's only luck that saves me. They can see too well, even in the dark. They can see so much better than I can. The riders have all the advantages. Up in the trees, so long as I can't hide, all I am presenting is a slightly tricky target, but the fun kind of tricky. And the more tired I get, the more I bleed, the more I hurt, the slower I will become. And if I don't change the game, I am going to lose. I have to even the odds. I have to do something they won't expect. If I can't see, then I must trust my other senses. Sucking in a deep breath, ignoring the pain in my leg and the arrow still sticking out of it, axe in hand, I take a running jump off the branch with a howl. The riders try to turn their horses to get away from me. I catch a rider in the chest with the axe. The point of it folds his armor inward, which is quite a trick, or would have been if I didn't lose my balance a moment later. The weapon comes out of my hand as I fall. I hit the dirt hard, knocking the breath out of me. Immediately, I roll to avoid hoof strikes. My head is ringing, and my leg feels as though it's on fire when I push myself to my feet. I cracked the spine of the arrow sticking out of me, but I drove the point deeper. The rider I struck is hanging in his saddle, his body limp and his mouth bubbling red. Another rider reels to the side while a third comes straight on. I draw a knife as the archer coming toward me attempts to switch back his sword. 6-1 is much better odds, especially when four of the riders are hanging back, as though they hadn't considered that they could get hurt too.
Ferocious enough for you? I shout at them.
The silver-eyed rider comes at me, and I throw my knife. It misses him, but hits the horse in the flank. The animal rears up, but as he tries to get his mount back under control, another barrels toward me. I grab for the axe, take a deep breath, and focus. The skeletal horse watches me with its pupilless white eyes. It looks hungry. If I die here in the woods because I wasn't better prepared, because I was too distracted to bother to strap on my own stupid sword, I will be absolutely furious with myself. I brace as another rider bears down on me, but I am not sure I can withstand the charge. Frantically, I try to come up with another option. When the horse is close, I drop to the ground, fighting every instinct for survival, every urge to run from the huge animal. It rushes over me, and I lift the axe and chop upward. Blood spatters my face. The creature runs a little farther, and then drops with a vicious keening sound, trapping its rider's legs underneath its bulk. I push to my feet, wiping my face just in time to see the silver-eyed knight preparing to charge. I grin at him, lifting the bloody axe. The amber-eyed rider heads toward his fallen comrade, calling for the others. The silver-eyed knight wheels around at the sound, heading toward his companions. The trapped rider struggles as I watch the other two knights pulling him free and up onto one of the other horses. Then the six wheel away through the night, no more laughter following them. I wait, afraid they might double back, afraid that something worse is about to leap from the shadows. Minutes slip by. The loudest sound is my ragged breath and the roaring of blood in my ears. Shakily, painfully, I walk on through the woods, only to find my own steed lying in the grass, being devoured by the dead rider's horse. I wave my axe, and it runs away. Nothing makes my poor horse any less dead, though. My pack is gone from her back. It must have fallen during the ride, taking my clothing and crossbow with it. My knives are gone, too, littering the forest after I threw them, probably lost in the brush. At least Nightfell is still here, tied to the saddle. I unstrap my father's sword with cramping fingers. Using it as a cane, I manage to drag myself the rest of the way to Maddox's stronghold and wash off the blood in the pump outside. Inside, I find Oriana sitting near a window, sewing on an embroidery hoop. She looks at me with her pink eyes and does not bother to smile, as a human might, to put me at ease.
Taryn is upstairs with Vivi and her lover. Oak sleeps and Maddox schemes.
She takes in my appearance.
Did you fall in a lake?
I nod. Stupid, right? She takes another stitch. I head for the stairs, and she speaks again before my foot can hit the first step.
Would it be so terrible for Oak to stay with me and Fairy? She asks.
There is a long pause, and then she whispers,
I do not wish to lose his love.
I hate that I have to say what she already knows. Here, there would be no end to courtiers pouring poison in his ear. Whispers of the king he would be if only Cardan was out of the way. And that, in turn, might make those loyal to Cardan desirous of getting Oak out of the way. And that's not even thinking about the biggest threats. So long as Baelkin lives, Oak's safest far from Faerie. Plus there's Orla. She nods, her expression bleak, and turns back to the window. Maybe she just needs someone else to be the villain. Someone to be responsible for keeping them apart. Good luck for her that I am someone she already doesn't much like. Still, I remember what it was like to miss where I grew up, miss the people who raised me. You'll never lose his love, I say, my voice coming out as quietly as hers did. I know she can hear me, but still, she doesn't turn. With that, I go up the stairs, leg aching. I'm at the landing when Maddox comes out of his office and looks up at me. He sniffs the air. I wonder if he smells the blood still running down my leg, if he smells the dirt and sweat and cold well water. A chill goes to my bones. I go into my old room and shut the door. I reach beneath my headboard, and I'm grateful to find that one of my knives is still there, sheathed and a little dusty. I leave it where it was, feeling a little safer. I limp over to my old tub, bite the inside of my cheek against the pain, and sit down on the edge. Then I slice my pants and inspect what remains of the arrow embedded in my leg. The cracked shaft is willow, stained with ash. What I can see of the arrowhead is made of jagged antler. My hands start to shake, and I realize how fast my heart is beating. How fuzzy my head feels. Arrow wounds are bad, because every time you move, the wound worsens. Your body can't heal with a sharp bit cutting up tissue, and the longer it's there, the harder it is to get out. Taking a deep breath, I slide my fingers down to the arrowhead and press on it lightly. It hurts enough that I gasp and go lightheaded for a moment, but it doesn't seem lodged in bone. I brace myself, take the knife, and cut about an inch down the skin of my leg. It's excruciating, and I am breathing in shallow huffs by the time I work my fingers into the skin and pull the arrowhead free. There's a lot of blood, a scary amount. I press my hand against it, trying to stop the flow. For a while, I am too dizzy to do anything but sit there.
Jude?
It's Vivi, opening the door. She takes a look at me, and then at the tub. Her cat eyes widen. I shake my head. Don't tell anyone. You're bleeding, she says. Get me. I start, and then stop, realizing that I need to stitch up the wound, that I didn't think of that. Maybe I am not as okay as I thought I was. Shock doesn't always hit right away. I need a needle and thread, not thin stuff, embroidery floss, and a cloth to keep putting pressure on the wound. She frowns at the knife in my hand, the freshness of the wound. Did you do that to yourself? That snaps me out of my daze for a moment. Yes, I shot myself with an arrow. Okay. She hands me a shirt from the bed and then goes out of the room. I press the fabric against the wound, hoping to slow the bleeding. When she gets back, she's holding white thread and a needle. That thread is not going to be white for long. Okay, I say, trying to concentrate. You want to hold or sew? Hold, she says, looking at me as though she wished there was a third option. Don't you think I should get Taryn? The night before her wedding? Absolutely not. I try to thread the needle, but my hands are shaking badly enough that it's difficult. Okay, now push the sides of the wound together. Vivi kneels down and does, making a face. I gasp and try not to pass out. Just a few more minutes, and I can sit down and relax, I promise myself. Just a few more minutes, and it will be like this never happened. I stitch. It hurts. It hurts and hurts and hurts. After I'm done, I wash the leg with more water and rip off the cleanest section of the shirt to wrap around it. She comes closer. Can you stand? In a minute. I shake my head.
What about Maddock? She asks. We could tell
no one, I say, and gripping the edge of the tub, kick my leg over, biting back a scream. Vivi turns on the taps, and water splashes out, washing away the blood. Your clothes are soaked, she says, frowning. Hand me a dress from over there, I say. Look for something sack-like. I force myself to limp over to a chair and sink into it. Then I pull off my jacket and the shirt underneath it, naked to my waist. I can't go any further without pain stopping me. Vivi brings over a dress, one so old that Taryn didn't bother to take it to me, and bunches it up so she can lift it over my head, then guides my hands through the armholes, as though I were a child. Gently, she takes off my boots and the remains of my pants.
You could lie down, she says. Rest. Heather and I can distract Taryn.
I am going to be fine, I say.
You don't have to do anything else, is all I'm saying. Vivi looks as though she's reconsidering my warnings about coming here. Who did this?
7 riders. Maybe knights.
But who was actually behind the attack? I don't know.
Vivi gives a long sigh.
Jude, come back to the human world with me. This doesn't have to be normal. This
isn't normal. I get up out of the chair. I would rather walk on the wounded leg than listen to more of this. What would have happened if I hadn't come in here? She demands. Now that I am up, I have to keep moving or lose momentum. I head for the door. I don't know, I say, but I do know this. Danger can find me in the mortal world, too. My being here lets me make sure you and Oak have guards watching you there. Look, I get that you think what I am doing is stupid, but don't act like it's useless. That's not what I meant, she says. But by then, I am in the hall. I jerk open the door to Taryn's room to find her and Heather laughing at something. They stop when we come in. Jude? Taryn asks. I fell off my horse, I tell her. And Vivi doesn't contradict me. What are we talking about? Taryn is nervous, roaming around the room to touch the gauzy gown she will wear tomorrow, to hold up the circlet, woven with greenery grown in goblin gardens, and fresh as the moment they were plucked. I realize that the earrings I bought for Taryn are gone, lost with the rest of the pack, scattered among leaves and underbrush. Servants bring wine and cakes, and I lick the sweet icing and let the conversation wash over me. The pain in my leg is distracting, but more distracting yet is the memory of the riders laughing, the memory of their closing in beneath the tree, the memory of being wounded and frightened and all alone. When I wake the day of Taryn's wedding, it is in the bed of my childhood. It feels like coming up from a deep dream, and for a moment, it's not that I don't know where I am, it's that I don't remember who I am. For those few moments, blinking in the late morning sunlight, I am Maddox's loyal daughter, dreaming of becoming a knight in the court. Then the last half year comes back to me, like the now familiar taste of poison in my mouth, like the sting of the sloppily done stitches. I push myself up and unwrap the cloth to look at the wound. It's ugly and swollen, and the needlework is poor. My leg is stiff, too. Narbonne, an enormous servant with long ears and a tail, comes into my room with a belated knock. He is carrying a tray with breakfast on it. Quickly, I flip the blankets over my lower body. He puts the tray on the bed without comment and goes into the bath area. I hear the rush of water and smell crushed herbs. I sit there, braced, until he leaves. I could tell him I'm hurt. It would be a simple thing. If I asked Narbonne to send for a military surgeon, he'd do it. He'd tell Oriana and Maddox, of course. But my leg would be stitched up well, and I'd be safe from infection. Even if Maddox had sent the riders, I believe he'd still take care of me. Courtesy, after all. He'd take it to be a concession, though. I'd be admitting that I needed him, that he won, that I'd come home for good. And yet, in the light of the morning, I am fairly sure it wasn't Maddox who sent the riders, even if it was the sort of trap he favors. He would have never sent assassins who hung back and who rode off when the numbers were still on their side. Once Narbonne goes out, I drink the coffee greedily and make my way to the bath. It's milky and fragrant, and only under the water can I allow myself to weep. Only under the water can I admit that I almost died, and that I was terrified, and that I wish there was someone to whom I could tell all that. I hold my breath until there's no more breath to hold. After the bath, I wrap myself in an old robe and make it to the bed. As I try to decide if it's worth sending a servant back to the palace to get me another dress, or if I should just borrow something of Taryn's, Oriana comes into the room, holding a silvery piece of cloth.
The servants tell me you brought no luggage, she says. I assume you forgot that your sister's wedding would require a new gown, or a gown at all.
At least one person is going to be naked, I say.
You know it's true. I've never been to a single revel in Faerie where everyone had clothes on.
Well, if that's your plan, she says, turning on her heels, then I suppose all you need is a pretty necklace.
Wait, I say. You're right. I don't have a dress, and I need one. Please don't go.
When Oriana turns, a hint of a smile is on her face. How unlike you. To say what you actually mean, and have it be something other than hostile.
I wonder how it is for her to live in Maddox's house, to be Maddox's obedient wife, and have had a hand in all of his schemes being undone. Oriana is capable of more subtlety than I would have given her credit for. And she has brought me a dress. That seems like a kindness, until she spreads it out on my bed.
It's one of mine, she says. I believe it will fit.
The gown is silver, and reminds me a little of chainmail. It's beautiful, with trumpet sleeves slashed along the length of the arm to show skin, but it has a plunging neckline, which would look one way on Oriana, and a totally different way on me. It's a little, daring for a wedding, don't you think? There's no way to wear it with a bra. She just looks at me for a moment, with a puzzled, almost insect-like stare. I guess I can try it on, I say, remembering that I had joked about being naked just a moment ago. This being Faerie, she makes no move to leave. I turn around, hoping that will be enough to draw attention away from my leg, as I strip. Then I pull the gown over my head and let it slither over my hips. It sparkles gorgeously, but as I suspected, it shows a lot of my chest. Like, a lot. Oriana nods, satisfied.
I will send someone to do your hair.
A short while later, a willowy pixie girl has braided my hair into ram's horns and wrapped the tips with silver ribbon. She paints the lids of my eyes and my mouth with more silver. Then, dressed, I go downstairs to join the rest of the family in Oriana's parlor, as though the last few months haven't happened. Oriana is dressed in a gown of pale violet, with a collar of fresh petals that rises to her powdery jawline. Vivi and Heather are both in mortal clothes. Vivi in a fluttery fabric with a pattern of eyes printed on the cloth, and Heather in a short pink dress with little silver spangles all over it. Heather's hair is pulled back in sparkling pink clips. Maddox is wearing a deep plum tunic, oak in a matching tone.
Hey, Heather says. We're both in silver.
Taryn isn't there yet. We sit around the parlor, drinking tea and eating bannocks.
Do you really think she's going to go through with this? Vivi asks.
Heather gives her a scandalized look, swats at her leg. Maddox sighs.
It is said we learn more from our failures than our successes,
he says, with a pointed look in my direction. Then Taryn finally comes down. She's been bathed in lilac dew and wears a gown of incredibly fine layers of cloth on top of one another, herbs and flowers trapped between them to give the impression that she's this beautiful floating figure and a living bouquet at the same time. Her hair is braided into a crown with green blooms all through it. She looks beautiful and painfully human. In all that pale fabric, she looks like a sacrifice instead of a bride. She smiles at all of us, shy and glowingly happy. We all rise and tell her how beautiful she looks. Maddox takes her hands and kisses them, looking at her like any proud father, even though he thinks she's making a mistake. We get into the carriage, along with the small Hob, who is going to be Oak's double, who switches jackets once we're inside, and then sits worriedly in a corner. On our way to Locke's estate, Taryn leans forward and catches my hand.
Once I am married, things will be different. Some things, I say.
not entirely sure what she's talking about.
Dad has promised to keep him in line, she whispers. I recall Taryn's appeal to me to have Locke dismissed from his position as Master of Revels. Curbing Locke's indulgences is likely to keep Matic busy, which seems like no bad thing.
Are you happy for me? She asks. Truly?
Taryn has been closer to me than any other person in the world. She has known the tide and undertow of my feelings, my hurts, both small and large, for most of my life. It would be stupid to let anything interfere with that. I want you to be happy, I say, today and always. She gives me a nervous smile, and her fingers tighten on mine. I am still holding her hand when the hedge maze comes into view. I see three pixie girls in diaphanous gowns fly over the greenery, giggling together, and beyond them, other folk already beginning to mill. As Master of Revels, Locke has organized a wedding worthy of the title.
Chapter 21. The first trap goes unsprung. The decoy climbs out with my family, while Oak and I duck down in the carriage. He grins at me at first, when we huddle down in the space between the cushioned benches, but the grin slips off his face a moment later, replaced by worry. I take his hand and squeeze it. Ready to climb through a window? That delights him anew.
From the carriage?
Yes, I say, and wait for it to pull around. When it does, there's a knock. I peek out and see the bomb inside the estate. She winks at me, and then I lift Oak and feed him, hooves first, through the carriage window and into her arms. I climb after, inelegantly. My dress is ridiculously revealing, and my leg is still stiff, still hurting, when I fall onto Locke's stone floor. Anything? I ask, looking up at the bomb. She shakes her head, extending a hand to me.
That was always the long shot. My bet is on the maze.
Oak frowns, and I rub his shoulders. You don't have to do this, I tell him, although I'm not sure what we'll do if he says he won't.
I'm okay, he says, without looking into my eyes.
Where's my mom?
I'll find her for you, Twiggling, says the bomb, and puts her arm over his thin shoulder to lead him out.
At the doorway, she looks back at me and fishes something out of her pocket.
You seem to have hurt yourself. Good thing I don't just cook up explosives.
With that, she tosses me something. I catch it without knowing what it is, and then turn it over in my hand. A pot of ointment. I look back up to thank her, but she's already gone. Unstoppering the little pot, I breathe in the scent of strong herbs. Still, once I spread it over my skin, my pain diminishes. The ointment cools the heat of what was probably imminent infection. The leg is still sore, but nothing as it was. My seneschal, Cardin says, and I nearly drop the ointment. I tug down my dress, turning.
Are you ready to welcome Locke into your family?
The last time we were in this house, in the maze of the gardens, his mouth was streaked with golden nevermore, and he watched me kiss Locke with a simmering intensity that I thought was hatred. Now he studies me with a not dissimilar look, and all I want to do is walk into his arms. I want to drown my worries in his embrace. I want him to say something totally unlike himself, about things being okay.
Nice dress,
he says instead. I know the court must already think I am besotted with the High King, to endure being crowned Queen of Mirth and still serve as his seneschal. Everyone must think, as Matic does, that I am his creature. Even after he humiliated me, I came crawling back. But what if I actually am becoming besotted with him? Cardin is more knowledgeable than I am at love. He could use that against me, just as I asked him to use it against Nikasia. Perhaps he found a way to turn the tables after all. Kill him, a part of me says,
a part I remember from the night I took him captive. Kill him before he makes you love him. You shouldn't be alone, I say, because if the Undersea is going to strike, then we must not give it any easy targets. Not tonight. Cardin grins.
I hadn't planned on it.
The offhand implication that he's not alone most nights bothers me, and I hate that it does. Good, I say, swallowing that feeling, though it feels like swallowing bile. But if you're planning on taking someone to bed, or better yet, several someones, choose guards, and then have yourselves guarded by more guards.
A veritable orgy.
He seems delighted by the idea. I keep thinking of the steady way he looked at me when we were both naked, before he pulled on his shirt and fastened those elegant cuffs.
We should have called truce,
he'd said, brushing back his ink-black hair impatiently.
We should have called truce long before this. But neither of us called it.
Not then. Not after. Jude, he'd said, running a hand up my calf. Are you afraid of me? I clear my throat, forcing the memories away. I command you not to allow yourself to be alone from tonight's sundown to tomorrow's sunup. He draws back, as though bitten. He no longer expects me to deliver orders in this high-handed way, as though I don't trust him. The High King of Elfheim makes a shallow bow.
Your wish? No. Strike that. Your command is my command,
he says. I cannot look at him as he goes out. I am a coward. Maybe it's the pain in my leg. Maybe it's worry over my brother. But a part of me wants to call after him, wants to apologize. Finally, when I am sure he's gone, I head toward the party. A few steps, and I am in the hallway. Maddox leans against the wall. His arms are crossed over his chest, and he shakes his head at me.
It never made sense to me. Until now.
I stop. What?
I was coming in to get Oak when I heard you speaking with the High King. Forgive me for eavesdropping.
I can barely think through the thundering in my ears. It's not what you think.
If it wasn't, you wouldn't know what I thought.
Maddox counters.
Very clever, daughter. No wonder you weren't tempted by anything I offered you. I said I wouldn't underestimate you, and yet I did. I underestimated you. And I underestimated both your ambition and your arrogance.
No, I say. You don't understand.
Oh, I think I do,
he says, not waiting for me to explain about Oak's not being ready for the throne, about my desire to avoid bloodshed, about how I don't even know if I can hang on to what I have for longer than a year and a day. He's too angry for any of that.
At last. I finally understand. Orla and the Undersea we will vanquish together. But when they are gone, it will be us staring across a chessboard at each other. And when I best you, I will make sure I do it as thoroughly as I would any opponent who has shown themselves to be my equal.
Before I can think of what to say to that, he grabs hold of my arm, marching us together onto the green.
Come,
he says.
We have roles yet to play.
Outside, blinking in the late afternoon sun, Maddox leaves me to go speak with a few knights standing in a tight knot near an ornamental pool. He gives me a nod when he departs, the nod of someone acknowledging an opponent. A shiver goes through me. When I confronted him in Hollow Hall after poisoning his cup, I thought I had made us enemies. But this is far worse. He knows I stand between him and the crown, and it matters little whether he loves or hates me. He will do whatever it takes to wrest that power from my hands. With no other options, I head into the maze, toward the celebration at its center. Three turns, and it seems that the partygoers are farther away. Sounds grow muffled, and faint laughter comes from every direction. The boxwoods are high enough to be disorienting. 7 turns, and I am truly lost. I start back, only to find the maze has changed itself around. The paths are not where they were before. Of course, it can't just be a normal maze. No, it's got to be out to get me. I remember that among this foliage are the tree folk, waiting to keep Oak safe. Whether they're the ones messing with me now, I do not know, but at least I can be sure something is listening when I speak.
I will slice my way clean through you, I say to the leafy walls. Let's start playing fair.
Branches rustle behind me. When I turn, there's a new path. This better be the way to the party, I grumble, starting on it. I hope this doesn't lead to the secret oubliette reserved for people who threaten the maze. Another turn, and I come to a stretch of little white flowers and a stone tower built in miniature. From inside, I hear a strange sound, half growl and half cry. I draw Nightfell. Not many things weep in Faerie, and the weeping things that are more common here, like banshees, are very dangerous.
Who is in there? I say. Come out, or I am coming in.
I'm surprised to see Heather shuffle into view. Her ears have grown furred and long, like that of a cat. Her nose is differently shaped, and the stubs of whiskers are growing above her eyebrows and from the apples of her cheeks. Worse, since I can't see through it, it's not a glamour. It's a real spell of some kind, and I don't think it's done with her. As I watch, a light dusting of fur grows along her arms in a patterning not unlike a tortoiseshell cat.
What happened? I stammer.
She opens her mouth, but instead of an answer, a piteous yowling comes out. Despite myself, I laugh, not because it's funny, but because I'm startled. Then I feel awful, especially when she hisses. I squat down, wincing at the pulling of my stitches.
Don't panic. I'm sorry. You just took me by surprise.
This is why I warned you to keep that charm on you. She makes another hissing yowl. Yeah, I say, sighing. No one likes to hear, I told you so. Don't worry. Whatever jerk thought this was going to be a fun prank is about to have a lot of regrets. Come on. She follows me, shivering. When I try to put an arm around her, she flinches away with another hiss. At least she remains upright. At least she is human enough to stay with me and not run off. We plunge into the hedges, and this time the maze doesn't mess with us. In 3 turns, we are standing among guests. A fountain splashes gently, the sound of it mixing with conversation. I look around, searching for someone I know. Taryn and Locke aren't there. Most likely, they have gone to a bower, where they will make private vows to each other, their true fairy marriage, unwitnessed and mysterious. In a land where there are no lies, promises need not be public to be binding. Vivi rushes over to me, taking Heather's hands. Her fingers have curled under in a paw-like manner.
What's happened? Oriana demands.
Heather?
Oak wants to know. She looks at him with eyes that match my sister's. I wonder if that was the heart of the jest. A cat for a cat-eyed girl.
Do something, Vivi says to Oriana.
I am no deft hand at enchantments, she says.
Undoing curses was never my specialty.
Who did this? They can undo it.
My voice has a growl to it that makes me sound like Matic. Vivi looks up with a strange expression on her face.
Jude,
Oriana cautions, but Heather points with her knuckles. Standing by a trio of flute-playing fawns is a boy with cat ears. I stride across the maze toward him. One hand goes to the hilt of my sword.
All the frustration I feel over everything I cannot control
bends toward fixing this one thing. My other hand knocks the goblet of green wine out of his grip. The liquid pools on the clover before sinking into the earth under our feet.
"What is this?"
he demands. "You put a curse on that girl over there," I tell him. "Fix her, immediately."
"She admired my ears,"
the boy says.
"I was only giving her what she desired. A party favor."
"That's what I'm going to say after I gut you and use your entrails as streamers," I tell him. "I was only giving him what he wanted. After all, if he didn't want to be eviscerated, he would have honored my very reasonable request." With furious looks at everyone, he stomps across the grass and speaks a few words. The enchantment begins to dissipate. Heather weeps anew, though, as her humanity returns. Huge sobbing gasps shake her.
"I want to go,"
she says finally, in a quavering, wet voice.
"I want to go home, right now, and never come back."
Vivi should have prepared her better, should have made sure she always wore a charm, or better yet, two. She should never have let Heather wander off alone. I fear that, in some measure, this is my fault. Taryn and I hid from Vivi the worst of what it was to be human in Faerie. I think Vivi believed that because her sisters were fine, Heather would be too. But we were never fine.
"It's going to be okay,"
Vivi is saying, rubbing Heather's back in soothing circles.
"You're okay. Just a little weirdness. Later, you're going to think it was funny."
"She's not going to think it was funny," I say, and Vivi flashes me an angry look. The sobbing continues. Finally, Vivi puts her finger under Heather's chin, raising her face to look fully into it.
"You're okay,"
Vivi says again, and I can hear the glamour in her voice. The magic makes Heather's whole body relax.
"You don't remember the last half hour. You've been having a lovely time at the wedding, but then took a spill. You were crying because you bruised your knee. Isn't that silly?"
Heather looks around, embarrassed, and then wipes her eyes.
"I feel a little ridiculous," she says with a laugh. "I guess I was just surprised."
"Vivi," I hiss.
"I know what you're going to say,"
Vivi tells me under her breath, "but it's just this one time. And before you ask, I've never done it before."
"But she doesn't need to remember all of that."
"Of course she does," I say, "or she won't be careful next time." I am so angry that I can barely speak, but I need to make Vivi understand. I need to make her realize that even terrible memories are better than weird gaps or the hollowness of your feelings not making sense. But before I can begin, the ghost is at my shoulder, Bolsabur beside him. They are both in uniform.
"Come with us," the ghost says, uncharacteristically blunt.
"What is it?" I ask them, my voice sharp. I am still thinking about Vivi and Heather. The ghost is as grim as I've ever seen him.
"The Undersea made its move."
I look around for Oak, but he is where I left him moments before, with Oriana. Watching Heather insist that she's fine. A small frown creases the space between his brows, but he seems otherwise utterly safe from everything but bad influence. Cardin stands on the other side of the green, near where Taryn and Locke have just come back from swearing their vows. Taryn looks shy, with roses in her cheeks. Folk rush over to kiss her. Goblins and Griggs, court ladies and hags. The sky is bright overhead, the wind sweet and full of flowers.
"The Tower of Forgetting. Bolsabur insists you ought to see it," the bomb says.
I didn't even notice her walking up. She's all in black, her hair pulled into a tight bun.
"Jude?"
I turn back to my spies. I don't understand.
"We will explain on the way,"
Bolsabur says.
"Are you ready?"
"Just a second. I should congratulate Taryn before I leave. kiss her cheeks, and say something nice. And then she will know I was here, even if I had to go. But as I look toward her, evaluating how swiftly I can do that, my gaze catches on her earrings. Dangling from her lobes are a moon and a star, the same ones I bargained for from Grimson, the ones I lost in the wood. She wasn't wearing them when we got in the carriage, so she must have got them. Beside her, Locke is smiling his fox smile, and when he walks, he has a slight limp. For a moment, I just stare, my mind refusing to acknowledge what I am seeing. Locke. It was Locke with the riders. Locke and his friends on the night before he was to be married. A bachelor party of sorts. I guess he decided to pay me back for threatening him. That, or perhaps he knew he could never stay faithful and decided to go after me before I came back for him. I take one last look at them and realize I can do nothing now. Pass the news about the undersea on to the Grand General, I tell the bomb. And make sure.
I'll watch over your brother, she reassures me. And the High King.
Turning my back on the wedding, I follow Vulsabur and the ghost. Yellow horses with long manes are nearby, already saddled and bridled. We swing up onto them and ride to the prison. From the outside, the only evidence that something might be wrong is the waves striking higher than I've ever seen them. Water has pooled on the uneven flagstones. Inside, I see the bodies. Knights, lying pale and still. The few on their backs have water filling their mouths, as though their lips were the edges of cups. Others lie on their sides. All their eyes have been replaced with pearls. Drowned on dry land. I rush down the stairs, terrified for Cardin's mother. She is there, though, alive. Blinking out at me from the gloom. For a moment, I just stand in front of her cell, hand on my chest in relief. Then I draw Nightfell and cut straight down between bar and lock. Sparks fly, and the door opens. Asha looks at me suspiciously. Go, I say. Forget our bargains. Forget everything. Get out of here.
Why are you doing this?
She asks me.
For Cardin.
I say. I leave unsaid the second part. Because his mother is still alive, and mine is not. Because even if he hates you, at least he should get a chance to tell you about it. With one baffled look back at me, she begins to ascend. I need to know if Baelkin is still imprisoned. If he's still alive. I head lower, picking my way through the gloom with one hand against the wall and the other holding my blade. The ghost calls my name, probably because of Asha's abrupt arrival in front of him. But I am intent on my purpose. My feet grow swifter and more sure on the spiral steps. I find Baelkin's cell is empty, the bars bent and broken, his opulent rugs wet and covered in sand. Orla took Baelkin, stole a prince of fairy from right under my nose. I curse my own short-sightedness. I knew they were meeting, knew they were scheming together. But I was sure, because of Nikasia, that Orla truly wanted Cardin to be the bridegroom of the sea. It didn't occur to me that Orla would act before hearing an answer, and I didn't think that when she threatened to take blood, she meant Baelkin. Baelkin! It would be difficult to get the crown of fairy on his head without Oak putting it there. But should Cardin ever abdicate, that would mean a period of instability. Another coronation. Another chance for Baelkin to rule. I think of Oak, who is not ready for any of this. I think of Cardin, who must be persuaded to pledge himself to me again, especially now. I am still swearing when I hear a wave strike the rocks, hard enough to reverberate through the tower. The ghost shouts my name again, from closer by than I expect. I turn as he steps into view on the other side of the room. Beside him are three of the sea folk, watching me with pale eyes. It takes me a moment to put the image together, to realize the ghost is not restrained, nor even menaced.
To realize this is a betrayal.
My face goes hot. I want to feel angry, but instead I feel a roaring in my head that overwhelms everything else. The sea crashes against the shore again, slamming into the side of the tower. I am glad Nightfell is already in my hand. Why? I ask, hearing Nikasia's words pounding in my ears like the surf. Someone you trust has already betrayed you.
I served Prince Dane, the ghost says. Not you.
I begin to speak when there is a rustle behind me, then pain in the back of my skull, and nothing more.
Book 2. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. They took her lightly back, between the night and morrow. They thought that she was fast asleep, but she was dead with sorrow. They have kept her ever since, deep within the lake, on a bed of flag leaves, watching till she wake. William Allingham, The Fairies. Chapter 22. I wake at the bottom of the sea. At first, I panic. I have water in my lungs and a terrible pressure on my chest. I open my mouth to scream, and a sound comes out, but not the one I expect. It startles me enough to stop and realize that I am not drowning. I am alive. I am breathing water, heavily, laboriously, but I am breathing it. Beneath me is a bed shaped from reef coral and padded with kelp, long tendrils of which flutter with the current. I am inside a building, which seems also of coral. Fish dart through the windows. Nikasia floats at the end of my bed, her feet replaced by a long tail. It feels like seeing her for the first time, to see her in the water, to see her blue-green hair whirl around her, and her pale eyes shine metallic under the waves. She was beautiful on land, but here she looks elemental, terrifying in her beauty.
This is for Cardan, she says, just before she balls up her fist and hits me in the stomach. I wouldn't have thought it possible to get the momentum needed to strike someone underwater, but this is her world, and she connects just fine. Ouch, I say. I try to touch where she hit me, but my wrists are restrained in heavy cuffs and won't move that far. I turn my head, seeing boulders anchoring me to the floor. A fresh panic grips me, bringing with it a sense of unreality.
I don't know what trick you performed on him, but I will discover it, she says, unnerving me with how close her guess comes to the mark. Still, it means she doesn't know anything. I force myself to concentrate on that, on the here and now, on discovering what I can do and making a plan. But it's hard when I am so very angry. Angry at the ghost for betraying me. Angry at Nikasia. And at myself. Myself. Always myself. More than anyone else. Furious at myself for winding up in this position. What happened to the ghost? I spit out. Where is he? Nikasia gives me a narrow-eyed look. What? He helped you kidnap me. Did you pay him? I ask, trying to sound calm. What I most want to know is what I cannot ask. Does she know the ghost's plans for the Court of Shadows? But to find out and stop him, I must escape. Nikasia puts her hand against my cheek, smooths back my hair.
Worry about yourself.
Maybe she only wants me here for reasons of personal jealousy. Maybe I can still get out of this. You think I performed a trick because Cardin likes me better than you, I say. But you shot at him with a crossbow bolt. Of course he likes me better. Her face goes pale, her mouth opening in surprise, and then curling into rage when she realizes what I am implying, that I told him. Maybe it's not a great idea to goad her into fury when I am powerless, but I hope she will be goaded into telling me why I am here and how long I must stay. Already, time has passed while I was unconscious. Time when Matic is free to scheme toward war with his new knowledge of my influence over the crown. When Cardin is entirely free to do whatever his chaotic heart desires. When Locke may make a mockery of everyone he can and draw them into his dramatics. When the council may push for capitulation to the sea, and I can do nothing to stop any of it. How much more time will I spend here? How long before all 5 months of work is undone? I think of Valmorin, tossing things in the air and letting them crash down around him, his human face and his unsympathetic human eyes. Nicasia seems to have regained her composure, but her long tail swishes back and forth.
Well, you're ours now, mortal. Cardin will regret the day he put any trust in you.
She means me to be more afraid, but I feel a little relief. They don't think I have any special power. They think I have a special vulnerability. They think they can control me as they would any mortal. Still, relief is the last thing I ought to show. Yeah, Cardin should definitely trust you more. You seem really trustworthy. It's not like you're actually currently betraying him. Nicasia reaches into a bandolier across her chest and draws a blade, a shark's tooth. Holding it, she gazes at me.
I could hurt you, and you wouldn't remember.
But you would, I say. She smiles.
Perhaps that would be something to cherish.
My heart thunders in my chest, but I refuse to show it. Want me to show you where to put the point? I ask. It's delicate work. Causing pain, without doing permanent damage.
Are you too stupid to be afraid?
Oh, I'm scared, I tell her. Just not of you. Whoever brought me here? Your mother, I presume, and Bilkin, has a use for me. I'm afraid of what that is, but not of you. An inept torturer who is irrelevant to everyone's plans. Nicasia says a word, and suffocating pain crashes in on my lungs. I can't breathe. I open my mouth, and the agony only intensifies. Better it's over fast, I tell myself. But it's not fast enough. The next time I wake, I am alone. I lie there, water flowing around me, lungs clear. Although the bed is still beneath me, I am aware of floating above it. My head hurts, and there is a pain in my stomach that is some combination of hunger and soreness after being punched. The water is cold, a deep chill that seeps into my veins, making my blood sluggish. I'm not sure how long I've been unconscious, not sure how long it's been since I was taken from the tower. As time slips by, and fish come to pluck at my feet and hair, at the stitches around my wound. Anger drains away, and despair fills me. Despair and regrets. I wish I'd kissed Terran's cheek before I left. I wish I'd made sure Vivi understood that if she loved a mortal, she had to be more careful with her. I wish I'd told Matic that I always intended for Oak to have the throne. I wish I'd planned more plans. I wish I'd left more instructions. I wish I had never trusted the ghost. I hope Cardin misses me. I'm not sure how long I float like that, how many times I panic and pull against my chains. how many times the weight of the water over me feels oppressive, and I choke on it. A merman swims into the room. He moves through the water with immense grace. His hair is a kind of striped green, and the same stripes continue down his body. His large eyes flash in the indifferent light. He moves his hands and makes a few sounds I don't understand. Then, obviously adjusting his expectations, he speaks again.
I am here to prepare you to join Queen Orla for dinner. If you give me any trouble, I can equally, easily, render you unconscious. That's how I'd hoped to find you.
I nod. No trouble. Got it. More merfolk come into the room. Ones with green tails, and yellow tails, and black-tipped tails. They swim around me, staring with their large, shining eyes. One unshackles me from the bed, and another guides my body upright. I have almost no weight in the water. My body goes where it is pushed. When they begin undressing me, I panic again. A kind of animal response. I twist in their arms, but they hold me firm and pull a diaphanous gown over my head. It is both short and thin, barely a garment at all. It flows around me, and I am sure most of my body is visible through it. I try not to look down, for fear that I will blush. Then I am wrapped in ropes of pearls, my hair pulled back with a crown of shells and a net of kelp. The wound on my leg is dressed with a bandage of seagrass. Finally, I am guided through the vast coral palace, its dim light punctuated by glowing jellyfish. The merfolk lead me into a banquet room without a ceiling, so that when I look up, I see schools of fish, and even a shark above me, and above that, the glimmering light of what must be the surface. I guess it's daytime. Queen Orla sits on an enormous throne-like chair at one end of the table, the body of it encased with barnacles and shells, crabs and live starfish crawling over it, fan-like coral and bright anemones moving in the current. She herself is impossibly regal. Her black eyes rake over me, and I flinch, knowing that I am looking at someone who has ruled longer than the span of generations of mortal lives. Beside her sits Nikasia, in an only slightly less impressive chair, and at the other end of the table is Baelkin, in a chair much diminished from either of theirs.
Jude Duarte, he says, now you know how it feels to be a prisoner. How is it to rot in a cell? To think you will die there?
I don't know, I tell him. I always knew I was getting out. At that, Queen Orla tips back her head and laughs.
I suppose you have, in a manner of speaking, come to me.
I hear the glamour in her voice, and remember what Nikasia said about my not remembering whatever she did to me. Truly, I should be glad she didn't do worse. My flimsy gown makes it clear I am not wearing any charms. They do not know the gesh Dane put on me. They believe I am entirely susceptible to glamours. I can pretend. I can do this. I swim over, keeping my face carefully blank. Orla gazes deeply into my eyes, and it's excruciatingly hard not to look away. To keep my face open and sincere. We are your friends, Orla says, stroking my cheek with long nails. You love us very much, but you must never tell anyone how much outside this room. You are loyal to us, and would do absolutely anything for us. Isn't that right, Jude Duarte? Yes, I say readily.
What would you do for me, little minnow?
She asks. Anything, my queen, I tell her. She looks down the table at Baelkin.
You see, that's how it's done.
He appears sullen.
He thinks a lot of himself and mislikes being put in his place. The eldest of Eldred's children. He resented his father for not seriously considering him for the throne. I am sure he hates the way Orla talks to him. If he didn't need this alliance, and if he weren't in her domain, I doubt he would allow it. Perhaps here is a divide for me to exploit. Soon a parade of dishes is brought out in cloches full of air, so that even under the water, they are dry until about to be eaten. Raw fish, cut into artful rosettes and cunning shapes. Oysters, perfumed with roasted kelp. Roe, glistening red and black. I don't know if I may eat without being explicitly granted permission, but I am hungry and willing to risk being reprimanded. The raw fish is mild and mixed in some peppery green. I didn't anticipate liking it, but I do. I quickly swallow 3 pink strips of tuna. My head still hurts, but my stomach starts to feel better. As I eat, I think about what I must do. Listen carefully, and act in every way as though I trust them, as though I am loyal to them. To do that, I must imagine myself into at least the shadow of that feeling. I look over at Orla, and imagine that it was she, instead of Matic, who brought me up, that I was Nicasia's sort of sister, who was sometimes mean, but ultimately looked out for me, at Baelkin. My imaginings balk, but I try to think of him as a new member of the family, someone I was coming to trust, because everyone else did. I turn a smile on them, a generous smile, that almost doesn't feel like a lie. Orla looks over at me. Tell me about yourself, little minnow. The smile almost wavers, but I concentrate on my full stomach, on the wonder and beauty of the landscape. There's little to know, I say. I'm a mortal girl who was raised in Faerie. That's the most interesting thing about me. Nicasia frowns.
Did you kiss Cardin?
Is that important?
Baelkin wants to know. He is eating oysters, spearing them one after the other with a tiny fork. Orla doesn't answer, just nods toward Nicasia. I like that she does that, putting her daughter above Baelkin. It's good to have something to like about her, something to concentrate on to keep the warmth in my voice real.
It's important. If it's the reason he didn't agree to an alliance with the Undersea, Nicasia says.
I don't know if I am supposed to answer, I say, looking around in what I hope appears like honest confusion. But yes. Nicasia's expression crumples. Now that I am glamored, she doesn't seem to think of me as a person in front of whom she has to pretend stoicism.
More than once? Does he love you?
I didn't realize how much she'd hoped I was lying when I told her I kissed him. More than once. But no, he doesn't love me. Nothing like it. Nicasia looks at her mother, inclining her head, indicating she got the answers she wanted.
Your father must be very angry with you for ruining all his plans, Orla says, turning the conversation to other things.
He is, I say, short and sweet. No lies I don't have to tell.
Why didn't the general tell Baelkin about Oak's parentage? She continues. Wouldn't that have been easier than scouring Elfheim for Prince Cardin after taking the crown?
I am not in his confidence, I say. Not then, and definitely not now. All I know is that he had a reason.
Doubtless,
Baelkin says.
He meant to betray me.
If Oak was High King, then it would really be Matic who ruled Elfheim, I say, because it's nothing that they don't know.
And you didn't want that.
A servant comes in with a little silken handkerchief filled with fish. Orla spears one with a long fingernail, causing a thin ribbon of blood to snake toward me in the water.
Interesting.
Since it's not a question, I don't have to answer. A few other servants begin to clear the plates.
And would you take us to Oak's door?
Bilkin asks.
Take us to the mortal world, and take him from your big sister. Carry him back to us?
Of course, I lie. Bilkin shoots a look toward Orla. If they took Oak, they could foster him under the sea. They could marry him to Nikasia. They could have a Greenbrier line of their own, loyal to the undersea. They would have options beyond Bilkin for access to the throne, which cannot please him. A long game, but in Faerie, that's a reasonable way to play.
This Grimson creature, Orla asks her daughter. You really believe he can make a new crown?
My heart feels for a moment as though it stuttered to a stop. I'm glad no one was looking at me, because in that moment, I do not believe I could have hidden my horror.
He made the blood crown, says Bilkin. If he made that, surely he can make another.
If they don't need the blood crown, then they don't need Oak. They don't need to foster him. Don't need him to place the crown on Bilkin's head. Don't need him alive at all. Orla gives him a look that's a reprimand. She waits for Nikasia's answer.
He's a smith, Nikasia says. He cannot forge beneath the sea, so he will always favor the land. But with the death of the Alder King, he craves glory. He wishes to have a high king who will give him that.
This is their plan, I tell myself, to try to stifle the panic I feel. I know their plan. If I can escape, then I can stop it. A knife in Grimson's back before he finishes the crown. I sometimes doubt my effectiveness as a seneschal, but never as a killer.
Little Minnow, Orla says, her attention returning to me. Tell me what Cardin promised you to help him.
But she, Nikasia begins.
But Orla's look silences her. Daughter, says the Queen of the Undersea, you do not see what is right beneath your nose.
Cardin got a throne from this girl. Stop searching for what she has over him, and start looking for what he had over her.
Nikasia turns a petulant look on me.
What do you mean?
You've said that Cardin didn't much care for her. And yet, she made him High King. Consider that perhaps he realized she'd be useful and exploited that usefulness through kisses and flattery, much as you've cultivated the little smith.
Nikasia looks puzzled, as though all her ideas of the world are upset. Perhaps she didn't think of Cardin as someone capable of scheming. Still, I can see something about this pleases her. If Cardin has seduced me to his side, then she need no longer worry that he cares for me. Instead, she need only worry over my usefulness.
What did he promise you for getting him the crown of Elfheim?
Orla asks me with exquisite gentleness. I always wanted a place in Faerie. He told me he would make me his seneschal, and put me at his right hand, like Valmorin in Eldred's court. He'd make sure I was respected, and even feared. It's a lie, of course. He never promised me anything. And Dane promised far less than that. But oh, if someone had, if Matic had, it would have been very hard to turn down.
You're telling me that you betrayed your father and put that fool on the throne in exchange for a job?
Bilkin demands incredulously. Being the High King of Elfheim is also a job, I return. And look at what has been sacrificed to get that. For a moment, I pause, wondering if I have spoken too harshly for them to believe I am still glamored. But Orla only smiles.
True, my dear, she says after a pause. And aren't we putting our faith in Grimson, even as we offer him a not particularly dissimilar reward?
Bilkin looks unhappy, but he doesn't dispute it. Far easier to believe that Cardin was the mastermind than a mortal girl. I manage to eat 3 more slices of fish and drink some kind of toasted rice and seaweed tea through a clever straw that leaves it unmixed with seawater before I am led to a sea cave.
Nikasia accompanies the merfolk guards, taking me there. This is no bedchamber, but a cage. Once I am pushed through, however, I discover that while I am still soaking wet, my surroundings are dry and filled with air I abruptly can't breathe. I choke, my body spasming, and up from my lungs comes all that water, along with a few pieces of partially digested fish. Nikasia laughs. Then, glamour heavy in her voice, she speaks.
Isn't this a beautiful room?
What I see is only a rough stone floor. No furniture, no nothing. Her voice is dreamy.
You'll love the four-poster bed, wrapped in coverlets, and the cunning little side tables, and your own pot of tea, still steaming. It will be perfectly warm and delicious whenever you try it.
She sets down a glass of seawater on the floor. I guess that's the tea. If I drink it, as she suggests, my body will become quickly dehydrated. Mortals can go for a few days without fresh water. But since I was breathing seawater, I may already be in trouble.
You know,
she says, as I pretend to admire the room, turning around in it in awe, feeling foolish.
Nothing I could do to you will be as terrible as what you'll do to yourself.
I turn to her, frowning in the pretense of puzzlement.
No matter,
she says, and leaves me to spend the rest of the evening tossing and turning on the hard floor, trying to seem as though I feel it is the height of comfort. Chapter 23. I wake to terrible cramps and dizziness. Cold sweat beads on my brow, and my limbs shiver uncontrollably. For the better part of a year, I have been poisoning my body every day. My blood is used to the doses, far higher than they were when I began. Addicted to them. Now, I can't do without the poison. I lie on the stone floor and try to marshal my thoughts. Try to remember the many times Matic was on a campaign and tell myself that he was uncomfortable on each one. Sometimes he slept stretched out on the ground, head pillowed on a clump of weeds and his own arms. Sometimes he was wounded and fought on anyway. He didn't die. I am not going to die, either. I keep telling myself that, but I am not sure I believe it. For days, no one comes. I give up and drink the seawater. Sometimes I think about Cardin while I am lying there. I think about what it must have been like to grow up as an honored member of the royal family, powerful and unloved, fed on cat milk and neglect, to be arbitrarily beaten by the brother you most resembled and who most seemed to care for you. Imagine all those courtiers bowing to you, allowing you to hiss and slap at them. But no matter how many of them you humiliated or hurt, you would always know someone had found them worthy of love when no one had ever found you worthy. Despite growing up among the folk, I do not always understand the way they think or feel. They are more like mortals than they believe. But the moment I allow myself to forget they're not human, they will do something to remind me. For that reason alone, I would be stupid to think I knew Cardin's heart from his story. But I wonder at it. I wonder what would have happened if I'd admitted he wasn't out of my system. They come for me eventually. They allow me a little water, a little food. By then, I am too weak to worry about pretending to be glamoured. I tell them the details I remember about Maddox's strategy room and what he thinks about Orla's intentions. I go over the murder of my parents in visceral detail. I describe a birthday, pledge my loyalty, explain how I lost my finger, and how I lied about it. I even lie to them
at their command. And then I have to pretend to forget when they tell me to forget. I have to pretend to feel full when they have told me I feasted, and to be drunk on imaginary wine when all I've had is a goblet of water. I have to allow them to slap me. I can't cry. Sometimes, when lying on the cold stone floor, I wonder if there's a limit to what I will let them do, if there is something that would make me fight back, even if it dooms me. If there is, that makes me a fool. But maybe if there isn't, that makes me a monster.
Mortal girl,
Bilkin says one afternoon, when we're alone in the watery chambers of the palace. He does not like using my name, perhaps because he doesn't like having to recall it. Finding me as disposable as all the human girls who have come through Hollow Hall. I am weak with dehydration. They regularly forget to give me fresh water and food, enchanting me illusory sustenance when I beg for it. I am having difficulty concentrating on anything. Despite the fact that Bailkin and I are alone in a coral chamber, with guards swimming patrols at intervals that I count automatically, I do not even try to fight and flee. I have no weapon, and little strength. Even were I able to kill Bailkin, I am not a strong enough swimmer to make it to the surface before they caught me. My plan has narrowed to endurance, to surviving hour by hour, sunless day by day. Perhaps I cannot be glamored, but that doesn't mean I cannot be broken. Nikasia has said that her mother has many palaces in the undersea, and that this, built into the rock of Innsweil and along the seafloor beneath it, is only one of them. But for me, it is a constant torment to be so close to home, and yet leagues beneath it. Cages hang in the water all through the palace, some of them empty, but many of them containing mortals with graying skin. Mortals who seem as though they ought to be dead, but occasionally move in ways that suggest they are not. The drowned ones, the guards sometimes call them. And more than anything, that's what I fear becoming. I remember thinking I'd spotted the girl I pulled out of Bailkin's house at Dane's coronation. The girl who threw herself into the sea. The girl who'd certainly drowned. Now I am not so sure I was wrong.
Tell me,
Bilkin says today.
Why did my brother steal my crown? Orla thinks she understands, because she understands the craving for power. But she doesn't understand Cardan. He never much cared for hard work. He liked charming people. He liked making trouble. But he despaired of real effort. And whether or not Nikasia would admit it, she doesn't understand either. The Cardan she knows might have manipulated you, but not into this.
This is a test, I think nonsensically. A test where I have to lie, but I am afraid my ability to make sense has deserted me. I am no oracle, I say, thinking of Valmorin and the refuge he's found in riddles.
Then guess,
he says.
When you paraded in front of my cell in the Tower of Forgetting, you suggested it was because I'd had a firm hand with him. But you, of all people, must believe he lacked discipline, and that I sought his improvement.
He must be remembering the tournament that Cardan and I fought, and the way he tormented me. I am tangled up in memories, in lies. I am too exhausted to make up stories. In the time I knew him, he drunkenly rode a horse through a lesson from a well-respected lecturer, tried to feed me to Nixies, and attacked someone at a revel, I say. He did not seem to be disciplined. He seemed to have his way all the time. Bailkin seems surprised.
He sought Eldred's attention,
he says finally.
For good or for ill. And mostly for ill.
Then perhaps he wants to be High King for Eldred's sake, I say. Or to spite his memory. That seems to draw Bailkin's attention.
though I said it only to suggest something that would misdirect him from thinking too much about Cardin's motives. Once it comes out of my mouth, I ponder whether there isn't some truth to it. Or because he was angry with you for chopping off Eldred's head, or being responsible for the deaths of all his siblings, or because he was afraid you might murder him, too. Bilkin flinches.
Be quiet,
he says, and I go gratefully silent. After a moment, he looks down at me.
Tell me which of us is worthy of being High King, myself, or Prince Cardin.
You are, I say easily, giving him a look of practiced adoration. I do not point out that Cardin is no longer a prince.
And would you tell him that yourself?
He asks. I would tell him whatever you wish, I say, with all the sincerity I can warily muster.
Would you go to him in his rooms and stab him again and again until his red blood ran out?
Bilkin asks, leaning closer. He says the word softly, as though to a lover. I cannot control the shudder that runs through me, and I hope he will believe it is something other than disgust. For you? I ask, shutting my eyes against his closeness. For Orla? It would be my pleasure. He laughs.
Such savagery.
I nod, trying to rein in over-eagerness at the thought of being sent on a mission away from the sea, at having the opportunity for escape. Orla has given me so much, treated me like a daughter. I want to repay her, despite the loveliness of my chambers and the delicacies I am given. I was not made to be idle.
A pretty speech. Look at me, Jude.
I open my eyes and gaze up at him. Black hair floats around his face. And here, under the water, the thorns on his knuckles and running up his arms are visible, like the spiky fins of a fish.
Kiss me,
he says. What? My surprise is genuine.
Don't you want to?
He asks. This is nothing, I tell myself. Certainly better than being slapped. I thought you were Orla's lover, I tell him. Or Nikasia's. Won't they mind?
Not in the least,
he tells me, watching carefully. Any hesitation on my part will seem suspicious, so I move toward him in the water, pressing my lips against his. The water is cold, but his kiss is colder. After what I hope is a sufficient interval, I pull back. He wipes his mouth with the back of his hand, clearly disgusted. But when he stares down at me, there's greed in his eyes.
Now kiss me as though I were Cardin.
To buy myself a moment of reflection, I gaze into his owl eyes, run my hands up his thorned arms. It is clearly a test. He wants to know how much control he has over me. But I think he wants to know something else, too. Something about his brother. I force myself to lean forward again. They have the same black hair, the same cheekbones. All I have to do is pretend. The next day, they bring me a pitcher of clear river water, which I guzzle gratefully. The day after that, they begin to prepare me to return to the surface. The High King has made a bargain to get me back. I think over the many commands I gave him, but none was specific enough to have ordered his paying a ransom for my safe return. He had been free of me, and now he is willingly bringing me back. I do not know what that means. Perhaps politics demanded it. Perhaps he really, really didn't like going to meetings. All I know is that I am giddy with relief, wild with terror that this is some kind of a game. If we do not go to the surface, I fear I will not be able to hide the pain of disappointment. Bilkin glamours me again, making me repeat my loyalty to them, my love, my murderous intent toward Cardin.
Balekin comes to the cave where I am pacing back and forth, each scuff of my bare feet on the stone loud in my ears. I have never been so much alone, and I have never had to play a role for this long. I feel hollowed out, diminished.
When we return to Elfheim, we won't be able to see each other often,
he says, as though this is something I will greatly miss. I am so jumpy that I do not trust myself to speak.
You will come to Hollow Hall when you can.
I wonder at the idea that he anticipates living in Hollow Hall, that he doesn't expect to be put in the tower. I suppose his freedom is part of the price of my release, and I am surprised all over again that Cardin agreed to pay it. I nod.
If I need you, I will give you a signal. A red cloth dropped in your path. When you see it, you must come immediately. I expect that you will be able to fabricate some excuse.
I will, I say, my voice coming out too loud in my ears.
You must regain the High King's trust. Get him alone, and then find a way to kill him. Do not attempt it if people are around. You must be clever, even if it takes more than one meeting. And perhaps you can find out more of your father's schemes. Once Cardin is dead, we will need to move fast to secure the military.
Yes, I say. I take a breath, and then dare to ask what I really want to know. Do you have the crown? He frowns.
Very nearly.
For a long moment, I do not speak. I let the silence linger. Into it, Balekin speaks.
Grimson needs you to finish your work before he can make it. He needs my brother dead.
Ah, I say, my mind racing. Once, Balekin risked himself to save Cardin. But now that Cardin stands between him and the crown, he seems willing enough to sacrifice his brother. I try to make sense of that, but I can't focus. My thoughts keep spiraling away. Balekin smiles a shark's grin.
Is something the matter?
I am almost broken. I feel a little faint, I say. I don't know what could be wrong. I remember eating. At least, I think I remember eating. He gives me a concerned look and calls for a servant. In a few moments, I am brought a platter of raw fish, oysters, and inky roe. He watches in disgust as I devour it.
You will avoid all charms, do you understand? No rowan, no bundles of oak, ash, and thorn. You will not wear them. You will not so much as touch them. If you are given one, you will cast it into a fire as soon as you can conceal doing so.
I understand, I say. The servant has brought no more fresh water for me, but wine instead. I drink it greedily with no care for the strange aftertaste, or how it goes to my head. Balekin gives me more commands, and I try to listen, but by the time he leaves, I am dizzy from the wine, exhausted, and sick. I curl up on the cold floor of my cell, and for a moment, right before I close my eyes, I can almost believe I am in the grand room they have been conjuring for me with their glamours. Tonight, the stone feels like a feather bed.
Chapter 24. The next day, my head pounds as I am once again dressed, and my hair is braided. Merfolk put me in my own clothes, the silver dress I wore to Taryn's wedding, now faded from exposure to salt, and frayed from being picked at by undersea creatures. They even strapped Nightfall onto me, although the scabbard is rusted, and the leather looks as though something has been feasting on it. Then I am taken to Balekin, dressed in the colors and wearing the sigil of the undersea. He looks me over and hangs new pearls in my ears. Queen Orla has assembled a huge procession of sea folk, merfolk, riders on enormous turtles and sharks, the selkies in their seal form, all cutting through the water. The folk on the turtles carry long red banners that fan behind them. I am seated on a turtle, beside a mermaid with two bandoliers of knives. She grips me firmly, and I do not struggle, though it is hard to keep still. Fear is terrible, but the combination of hope and fear is worse. I careen between the two, my heart beating so fast and my breaths coming so quickly that my insides feel bruised. When we begin to rise, up and up and up, a sense of unreality grips me. We crest the surface in the narrow stretch between Innsweil and Innsmire. On the shore of the island, Cardan sits in a fur-lined cloak, regal on a dappled gray steed. He is surrounded by knights in armor of gold and green. To one side of him is Matic, on a sturdy roan. To the other is Nior. The trees are full of archers. The hammered gold of the oak leaves on Cardan's crown seems to glow in the dimming light of sunset. I am shaking. I feel I may shake apart. Orla speaks from her place at the center of our procession.
King of Elfheim, as we agreed, now that you have paid my price, I've secured the safe return of your seneschal. And I bring her to you escorted by the new ambassador of the Undersea, Baelkin, of the Greenbriar line, son of Eldred, your brother. We hope this choice will please you, since he knows so many customs of the land.
Cardan's face is impossible to read. He doesn't look at his brother. Instead, his gaze goes to me. Everything in his demeanor is icy. I am small, diminished, powerless. I look down, because if I don't, I am going to behave stupidly. You have paid my price, Orla said to him. What might he have done for my return? I tried to recall my commands, to recall whether I forced his hand.
You promised her whole and hale, says Cardan.
And you can see she is so, Orla says. My daughter Nicasia, princess of the Undersea, will help her to the land with her own royal hands.
Help her?
Says Cardan.
She ought to need no help. You have kept her in the damp and the cold for too long.
Perhaps you no longer want her, Orla says. Perhaps you would bargain for something else in her place, King of Elfheim.
I will have her,
he says, sounding both possessive and contemptuous at once.
And my brother will be your ambassador. It shall all be as we agreed.
He nods toward two knights, who wade out to where I am sitting and help me down. Help me to walk. I am ashamed of my unsteady legs, of my weakness, of the ridiculousness of still being dressed in Oriana's utterly unsuitable dress for a party long over.
We are not yet at war, says Orla. Nor are we yet at peace. Consider well your next move, King of the land, now that you know the cost of defiance.
The knights guide me onto the land and past the other folk. Neither Cardan nor Matic turn as I pass them. A carriage is waiting a little ways into the trees, and I am loaded inside. One knight removes her helm. I have seen her before, but I do not know her. The general has instructed me to take you to his home, she says. No, I say. I have to go to the palace. She does not contradict me, nor does she relent. I must do as he says. And although I know I ought to fight, that once upon a time I would have, I don't. I let her shut the door of the carriage. I lean back against the seats and close my eyes. When I wake, the horses are kicking up dust in front of Maddox's stronghold. The knight opens the door, and Narbonne lifts me bodily from the carriage, as easily as I might have lifted oak, as though I am made of twigs and leaves instead of earthly flesh. He carries me to my old bedroom. Tatterfell is waiting for us. She takes down my hair and strips off my dress. carrying away Nightfell and putting me into a shift. Another servant sets down a tray holding a pot of hot tea and a plate of venison, bleeding onto toast. I sit on the rug and eat it, using the buttered bread to sop up the meat juices. I fall asleep there, too. When I wake, Taryn is shaking me. I blink hazily and stumble to my feet. I'm up, I say. How long was I lying there? She shakes her head.
Tatterfell says that you've been out for the whole day and night. She worried that you had a human illness. That's why she sent for me.
Come on, at least get in bed. You're married now, I say, recalling it suddenly. With that comes the memory of Locke and the riders, the earrings I was supposed to give her. It all feels so far away, so distant. She nods, putting her wrist to my forehead.
And you look like a wraith, but I don't think you have a fever.
I'm fine, I say, the lie coming automatically to my lips. I have to get to Cardan and warn him about the ghost. I have to see the Court of Shadows.
Don't act so proud, she says, and there are tears in her eyes. You disappeared on my wedding night, and I didn't even know you were gone until morning. I've been so frightened. When the Undersea sent word it had you, well, the High King and Matic blamed each other. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Every morning, I went to the edge of the water and looked down, hoping I could see you. I asked all the mermaids if they could tell me if you were okay, but no one would.
I tried to imagine the panic she must have felt, but I can't. They seem to have worked through their differences, I say, thinking of them together at the beach.
Something like it.
She makes a face, and I try to smile. Taryn helps me into my bed, arranging the cushions behind me. I feel bruised all over, sore and ancient, and more mortal than ever before. Vivi and Oak, I ask. Are they okay? Fine, she says.
Back home with Heather, who seems to have gotten through her visit to Fairyland without much drama.
She was glamored, I say. For a moment, I see anger cross her face, raw and rare.
Vivi shouldn't do that, Taryn says.
I'm relieved not to be the only one to feel that way. How long have I been gone?
A little over a month, she says,
which seems impossibly brief. I feel as though I have aged 100 years beneath the sea. Not only that, but now I am more than halfway through the year and a day Cardan promised. I sink back on the cushions and close my eyes. Help me get up, I say. She shakes her head.
Let the kitchen send up more soup.
It isn't difficult to persuade me. As a concession, Taryn helps me dress in clothes that were once too tight and now hang on me. She stays to feed me spoonfuls of broth. When she's ready to go, she pulls up her skirts and takes a long hunting knife out of the sheath attached to a garter. In that moment, it's clear we grew up in the same house. She puts the knife onto the coverlets beside a charm she takes from her pocket.
Here, she says, take them. I know they'll make you feel safer, but you must rest. Tell me you won't do anything rash.
I can barely stand on my own. She gives me a stern look. Nothing rash, I promise her. She embraces me before she goes, and I hang a little too long on her shoulders, drinking in the human smell of sweat and skin. No ocean, no pine needles, or blood, or night-blooming flowers. I doze off with my hand on her knife. I'm not sure when I wake, but it's to the sound of arguing.
Whatsoever the Grand General's orders, I am here to see the High King Seneschal, and I won't be put off with any more excuses.
It's a woman's voice, one I half recognize. I roll off the bed, heading dizzily out into the hall, where I can look down from the balcony. I spot Dulcamera from the Court of Termites. She looks up at me. There is a fresh cut on her face.
Your pardon,
She calls in a way that makes it clear she means nothing of the sort.
But I must have an audience. In fact, I am here to remind you of your obligations, including that one.
I recall Lord Roybin with his salt-white hair and the promise I made him for supporting Cardin half a year ago. He pledged to the crown and the new High King, but on a specific condition. Someday, I will ask your king for a favor, he said. What did I say in return? I tried to bargain. Something of equal value, and within our power. I guess he sent Dulcamera to call in that favor, though I do not know what use I am to be when I am like this. Is Oriana in her parlor? If not, show Dulcamera to it, and I will speak with her there, I say, gripping the railing so that I don't fall. Maddox's guards look unhappy, but they don't contradict me.
This way,
says one of the servants, and with a last hostile look at me, Dulcamera follows. This leaves me time to make my unsteady way down the stairs.
Your father's orders were that you not go out, one of the guards says,
used to my being a child to be minded, and not the High King Seneschal, with whom one might behave with more formality.
He wanted you to rest.
By which you mean, he didn't order me not to have audiences here, but only because he didn't think of it. The guard doesn't contradict me, only frowns. His concerns, and yours, are noted. I manage to make it to Oriana's parlor without falling over, and if I hold slightly too long to the wooden trim around windows or to the edges of tables, that's not so awful. Bring us some tea, please. As hot as you can make it, I say to a servant, who watches me a little too closely. Steeling myself, I let go of the wall and walk into the parlor, give Dulcamera a nod, and sink into a chair, although she has remained standing, hands clasped behind her back.
Now we see what your High King's loyalty looks like,
she says, taking a step toward me, her face hostile enough that I wonder if her purpose is more than speaking. Instinct wants to push me to my feet. What happened? At that, she laughs.
You know very well. Your king gave the Undersea permission to attack us. It came 2 nights ago, out of nowhere. Many of our people were slain before we understood what was happening. And now we are being forbidden from retaliating.
Forbidden from retaliating? I think of what Orla said about not being at war. But how can the land not be at war if the sea has already attacked? As the High King, Cardin owes his subjects the might of his military, of Maddox's army, when they are under threat. But to deny permission of striking back was unheard of. She bares her teeth.
Lord Roybin's consort was hurt,
she says.
Badly.
The green-skinned, black-eyed pixie who spoke as though she were mortal, the one whom the terrifying leader of the Court of Termites deferred to, laughed with. Is she going to live? I ask, my voice gone soft.
You best hope so, mortal,
Dulcamera says,
or Lord Roybin will bend his will to the destruction of your boy king, despite the vows he made.
We'll send you knights, I say. Let Elfheim rectify our mistake. She spits on the floor.
You don't understand. Your High King did this for you. Those were the terms under which Queen Orla would return you. Baelkin chose the Court of Termites as the target. The Undersea attacked us. And your Cardin let her. There was no mistake.
I close my eyes and pinch the bridge of my nose. No, I say. That's not possible.
Baelkin has long had a grudge against us. Daughter of dirt.
I flinch at the insult, but I do not correct her. She may rail at me all she likes. The High Court has failed the Court of Termites because of me.
We should never have joined the High Court. We should never have pledged to your fool of a king. I have come to deliver that message, and one message more. You owe Lord Roybin a favor, and it best be granted.
I worry over what he might ask me for. An unnamed favor is a dangerous thing to give, even for a mortal who cannot be forced to honor it.
We have our own spies, Seneschal. They tell us you're a good little murderer. Here is what we want. Kill Prince Baelkin.
I can't do that, I say, too astonished to weigh my words. I'm not insulted by her praise of my skill at killing, but setting me in an impossible task is hardly flattery either. He's the ambassador of the Undersea. If I killed him, we'd be at war.
Then go to war.
With that, she sweeps from the room, leaving me sitting in Oriana's parlor when the steaming tray of tea comes in. Once she is gone and the tea is cold, I climb the steps to my room. There, I take up Taryn's knife and the other one hidden under my bed. I take the edge of one to the pocket of my dress, slicing through it so I can strap the knife to my thigh and draw it swiftly. There are plenty of weapons in Maddox's house, including my own Nightfell. But if I start looking for them and belting them on properly, the guards are sure to notice. I need them to believe I have gone docilely back to bed. Padding to the mirror, I look to see if the knife is concealed beneath my dress. For a moment, I don't know the person looking back at me. I am horrified at what I see. My skin has a sickly pallor, and my weight has dropped enough to make my limbs look frail and stick-like, my face gaunt. I turn away, not wanting to look anymore. Then I go out onto the balcony. Normally, it would be no small thing to climb over the railing and scale the wall down to the lawn, but as I put one leg over, I realize how rubbery my legs and arms have become. I don't think I can manage the climb, so I do the next best thing. I jump. Chapter 25. I get up, grass stains on my knees, my palms stinging and dirty. My head feels unsteady, as though I am still expecting to move with the current, even though I am on land. Taking a few deep breaths, I drink in the feeling of the wind on my face and the sounds of it rustling the leaves of the trees. I am surrounded by the sense of land, of fairy, of home. I keep thinking about what Dulcamara said, that Cardin refused to retaliate for the sake of my safe return. That can't have made his subjects happy with him. I am not sure even Maddox would think it was a good strategy, which is why it's difficult to imagine why he agreed to it, especially since, if I stayed stuck in the Undersea, he'd be out of my control. I never thought he liked me enough to save me, and I am not sure I'll still believe it unless I hear his reasons from his lips. But for whatever reason he brought me back, I need to warn him about the ghost, about Grimson and the crown, about Baelkin's plan to make me into his murderer. I start toward the palace on foot. Sure, it will take the guards far longer to realize I have gone than it would to take the stable hands to discover a missing mount. Still, I am breathing hard soon after I start. Halfway there, I have to stop and rest on a stump. You're fine, I tell myself. Get up. It takes me a long time to make it to the palace. As I walk toward the doors, I square my shoulders and try not to show just how exhausted I am.
Seneschal, one of the guards at the gate says. Your pardon, but you are barred from the palace.
You're never to deny me an audience or give an order to keep me from your side. For a delirious moment, I wonder if I've been in the Undersea for longer than Taryn told me. Maybe a year and a day is up, but that's impossible. I narrow my gaze. By whose command?
Apologies, my lady, another knight says. His name is Diarmad. I recognize him as a knight Madoc has his eye on. Someone he would trust.
The general, your father, gave the order.
I have to see the High King, I say, trying for a tone of command. But instead a note of panic creeps into my voice.
The Grand General told us to call you a carriage if you came and, if necessary, ride in it with you. Do you expect you will require our presence?
I stand there, furious and outmaneuvered. No, I say. Cardan couldn't refuse me an audience, but he could allow someone else to give the order. So long as Madoc didn't ask for Cardan's permission, it didn't contradict my commands. And it wouldn't be so hard to figure out the sort of things I might have commanded Cardan. After all, most of it was stuff Madoc would probably have ordered himself. I knew that Madoc wanted to rule Faerie from behind the throne. It didn't occur to me that he might find his way to Cardan's side and cut me out. They played me, either together or separately. They played me. My stomach churns with anxiety. The feeling of being fooled, the shame of it, haunts me. It tangles up my thoughts. I recall Cardan sitting atop the dappled gray horse on the beach, his impassive face, furred cloak, and crown highlighting his resemblance to Eldred. I may have tricked him into his role, but I didn't trick the land into receiving him. He has real power. And the longer he's on the throne, the greater his power will become. He's become the High King, and he's done it without me. This is everything I feared when I came up with this stupid plan in the first place. Perhaps Cardan didn't want this power at first, but now that he has it, it belongs to him. But the worst part is that it makes sense that Cardan is out of my reach, for him to be inaccessible to me. Diarmad and the other knights stopping me at the palace doors is the fulfillment of a fear I've had since the crown was placed on Cardan's head. And as terrible as it feels, it also seems more reasonable than what I've been trying to convince myself of for months. That I am the seneschal of the High King of Faerie. That I have real power. That I can keep this game going. The only thing I wonder is why not let me languish beneath the sea? Turning away from the palace, I head through the trees to where there's an entrance into the Court of Shadows. I just hope I won't run into the ghost. If I do, I'm not sure what will happen. But if I can get to the roach and the bomb, then maybe I can rest a while and get the information I need and send someone to slit Grimson's throat before he has completed making the new crown. When I get there, though, I realize the entrance is collapsed. No, as I look at it more carefully, that's not exactly right. There's evidence of an explosion. Whatever destroyed this entrance did more damage than that. I cannot breathe. Kneeling in the pine needles, I try to understand what I am looking at, because it seems as though the Court of Shadows has been buried. This must have been the ghost's work. Betrayal on top of betrayal. I just hope the roach and the bomb are alive. Please let them be alive. And yet, without a way to find them, I am more trapped than ever. Numbly, I wander back toward the gardens. A group of fairy children has gathered around a lecturer. A lark boy picks blue roses from the royal bushes,
while Valmorin wanders beside him, smoking a long pipe,
his scald crow perched on one shoulder. His hair is unbrushed around his head, matted in places, and braided with bright cloth and bells in others. Laugh lines crease the corners of his mouth. "Can you get me inside the palace?" I ask him. It's a long shot, but I don't care about embarrassment anymore. If I can get inside, I can discover what happened to the Court of Shadows. I can get to Cardan. Valmorin's eyebrows rise.
"Do you know what they are?"
he asks me, waving a vague hand toward the boy,
who turns to give us both a sharp-eyed look.
Maybe Valmorin cannot help me.
Maybe Faerie is a place where a madman can play the fool and seem like a prophet. But maybe he is only a madman. The lark boy continues picking his bouquet, humming a tune. Fairies? I ask.
Yes, yes.
He sounds impatient.
The folk of the air. Insubstantial. Unable to hold one shape. Like the seeds of flowers launched into the sky.
The scald crow caws. Valmorin takes a long pull on his pipe.
When I met Eldred, he rode up on a milk-white steed, and all the imaginings of my life were as dust and ashes.
Did you love him? I ask.
Of course I did,
he tells me, but he sounds as though he's talking about long ago, an old tale that he only needs to tell the way it was told before.
Once I met him, all the duty I felt for my family was rendered as frayed and worn as an old coat. And the moment his hands were on my skin, I would have burned my father's mill to the ground to have him touch me again.
Is that love? I ask.
If not love, he says, something very like it.
I think of Eldred as I knew him, aged and bent. But I also recall the way he seemed younger when the crown was taken from his head. I wonder how much younger he would have grown had he not been cut down.
Please, I say, just help me get into the palace.
When Eldred rode up on his milk-white steed,
he says again,
he made me an offer. Come with me,
he said,
to the land under the hill, and I will feed you on apples and honey wine and love. You will never grow old. And all you wish to know, you may discover.
That sounds pretty good, I admit.
Never make a bargain with them,
he tells me, taking my hand abruptly.
Not a wise one or a poor one, not a silly one or a strange one, but especially not one that sounds pretty good.
I sigh. I've lived here nearly all my life. I know that. My voice startles his crow, which leaps from his shoulder to fly up into the sky.
Then know this, Valmorin says, looking at me. I may not help you. It is one of the things I gave up. I promised Eldred that once I became his, I would renounce all of humanity. I would never choose a mortal over a fairy.
But Eldred is dead, I insist.
And yet, my promise remains.
He holds his hands in front of him in acknowledgement of his helplessness. We're human, I say. We can lie. We can break our word. But the look he turns on me is pitying, as though I am the one who is mistaken. Watching him walk off, I make a decision. Only one person has a reason to help me. Only one person I can be sure of.
You will come to Hollow Hall when you can, Belkin told me. Now is as good a time as any.
I force myself to walk, though the path through the Milkwood is not a direct one, and it passes too close to the sea for my comfort. When I look out at the water, a shudder comes over me. It will not be easy to live on an island if I am tormented by waves. I pass by the Lake of Masks. When I look down, I see three pixies staring back at me with apparent concern. I plunge my hands in and scrub my face with the fresh water. I even drink a little, though it's magical water and I'm not sure it's safe. Still, fresh water was too dear for me to pass up an opportunity to have it. Once Hollow Hall is in sight, I pause for